The following is a podcast of Periodically Speaking, recorded live at the New York Public Library on May 13th, 2008.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Karen Cisone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals and Journals. And it's a pleasure to welcome you all here this evening for Periodically Speaking. This is our second event in our spring series, which runs April, May, and June. We have two events coming I just want to mention right now. Our next Periodically Speaking event is June 9th, and we also will host the 6th annual Magathon event in this room once again. We look forward to that, and that is on June 14th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're thrilled. We love hosting this event. It gives us an opportunity to tell you about the collection that's housed here. It's such a beautiful public space, but it also houses a really wonderful collection of literary magazines. So I want to invite you to come back, check out the collection, and check out the library. I also want to invite you for our post-reading reception, which will be right outside the room right after the reading. So I hope all of you will be able to stick around. I want to thank CLMP for being so wonderful to collaborate with over these last few years, Tasha and Jeffrey. Thank you very much. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Jeffrey Leppendorf, who is the executive director of CLMP, and he's going to introduce the program for this evening. Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Thank you, Karen, and thanks to all of you for being here on this beautiful spring evening. This has really been a wonderful series for us to present, and Karen Cisone, the New York Public Library Periodicals Collection, has been a really fantastic partner for us. The Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, CLMP, has for 40 years been helping independent literary publishers through the business of publishing. Without this community in particular, the three types of writing you're going to hear tonight, namely short fiction, poetry, and essays, would be very difficult for most readers to get access to. There are many others as well, but these in particular are supported almost entirely by this community of publishers. So they're doing very, very important work, and we're delighted to present a tiny selection of them through this series. Without further ado, I do want to say that to learn a little more about CLMP, we've presented a little cheat sheet for each of you, and I welcome you to invite you to visit our website as well for more information about independent literary publishing, should you yourself want to become an independent literary publisher, do talk to us. We're going to begin with a literary magazine whose name really tells it all. One story to tell you what might be missing. It's editor Hannah Tinty.
Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming. My name is Hannah Tinty. I'm the editor of One Story Magazine, and I want to start by just thanking CLMP for inviting us to take part in this reading series. We never would have made it as far as we have without the support of CLMP and how much they've done for us and so many other literary magazines and small presses. They're just a wonderful resource. And also I want to thank the New York Public Library for giving us this wonderful space to read in. It's so beautiful. I love to come here and peruse. One Story, for those of you who have never heard of us, is an independent literary magazine based in New York City that publishes one short story at a time. This is what it looks like. And we published our first issue in April 2002. Since then, One Story has been recognized in Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Prize Stories, Best American Voices, Best American Non-Required Reading, Best New Stories from the South, Best American Fantasy, Selected Shorts, and the Pushcart Prizes. We've grown our subscriber base from 200 people to 4,000 people. And recently we've become a nonprofit and received our first grant from the New York State Council of the Arts. We've also become recognized in the publishing world as a place to look for the best new writers and had articles written about us in the New York Times, Time Out New York, Poets and Writers, O, the Oprah Magazine, and Newsweek. But perhaps most satisfying of all, we've seen many one-story writers to go on and publish their very first books. The process of putting out a literary magazine requires an incredible amount of work. First, there is the mountain of manuscripts to wade through, days and months of reading time to find that perfect gem. Then there are the edits with the author, going back and forth to polish the story into the right shape. Then there's the copy editing and layout and proofreading and then printing and finally distributing to subscribers. Recently, we published our 100th issue. It's hard to believe that One Story has gone through that entire process I've just described 100 times. In many ways, the past 6 years have been a blur, but whenever I look at all of our issues spread out across the table, as I recently did when we moved into our very first office space, I remember all the details of working with these excellent writers and each special circumstance when I read their stories for the very first time. Since One Story is only one story, our authors literally are the issues, and frankly, our magazine wouldn't be anywhere without their incredible talent and skill. It gives me great pleasure to introduce one of our writers to you tonight. Patrick Ryan is the author of One Story issue number 53, So Much for Artemis, which went on to be included in Best American Short Stories. His first novel, Send Me, was published by the Dial Press in 2006 and was shortlisted for the Mercantile Library's John Sargent Senior Prize for Fiction, a Lambda Award, and a Quality Paperback Book Club Award. It was also selected for the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers series. He's the author of the young adult novel Saints of Augustine, listed as one of New York Public Library's best books for the teen age in 2007, and the forthcoming novel In Mike We Trust, both published by HarperCollins. In 2006, he received a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship for Fiction, and his story, Getting Heavy with Fate, received the 2005 Smart Family Foundation Award for Fiction. Tonight, he'll be reading from his novel in progress, Cecilia, which will be published by the Dial Press in 2009. Please join me in welcoming Patrick Ryan.
Thank you all for coming, and thanks to the library and to the council. And a great big thank you to Hannah Tinty, who is not just an amazing editor, but an amazing writer of fiction herself. This is set in the present day, and it's about a woman named Celia who just turned 60 and who spiraled into a crisis. She's gone through a heavy depression, she's had some unfortunate psychotherapy, and she's been overprescribed for everything from anxiety to insomnia, and her second marriage just collapsed. It's a real uplifting read, I promise. The fallout is that she has abruptly left both her home and her life. She's in her Buick, she's got a full tank of gas, a lot of cash, and an arsenal of pills in her glove compartment that she's considering taking at some point so she can go gently into that good night. But first she's taking inventory of her life, so she has decided to look up her old college friend, Faye, with whom she hadn't spoken in 40 years. Faye and Mickey Noonan lived in Leroy, New York, and they had Celia on their Christmas card list. Every year they tucked one into the card, one of those typed up informative but odd update letters that had no set point of view. Season's greetings. We Noonans hope this finds you happy and healthy, and we've had quite an interesting year. Mickey and I are very proud of Gerald, who is a divisional manager now in charge of five territories. We're also proud of Meredith, whose architectural designs are earning her international acclaim and who will become a mother herself next year. Way to go, Keith. Mickey got his wish in the fall and is now Captain Mickey, devoting much of his time to his Sea Ray, while Faye finally retired from the real estate business and fulfilled two lifelong dreams. She had a new deck put on the house with a gazebo and a jacuzzi, relaxing, and she got in touch with her theatrical roots and starred as Julie in a local production of Carousel. Who was telling all this, Celia would wonder, the family cat? Still, Celia and Faye had been fairly close for the last 2 years of college, and even though they hadn't maintained any sort of personal contact over the decades, she always sent Faye a card and was flattered to be kept inside the annual Noonan information loop. She imagined writing her own update letter. Hello from Buffalo. We Wickhams have been on something of a roller coaster this year. Jeff's still writing his dreadful novel and has been fucking two different women, neither one of whom is his wife, while Celia's gone mental and disappeared. Happy holidays. Of course, she didn't have to share her predicament with anyone. She didn't have to be long for this wretched world if she didn't want to, and a licensed quack had assured her she didn't owe anyone the truth. So why not invent a more glamorous version of herself? Mix things up, enjoy a closing act before the curtain goes down. She bought a map from the gas station attendant. Leroy looked to be little more than an hour away. Of course, there was every chance Faye might not be home. And even if she was, so many years had gone by that they might not know what to say to each other. Still, if nothing else, the excursion would get her out of Buffalo. 10 minutes later, her gloved hands clutching the wheel at 10 and 2, she was on the highway. Faye, now that she thought about it, had been the closest Cecilia had ever had to to having a sister. Faye had traveled in several different circles, hippies, artsy types, a radical group bent on reforming the student government, none of which Celia belonged to. But when it came to intimate friendship, one-on-one contact, Faye chose Celia. Even after she started dating Mickey, she still made time for Celia, and Celia relished in her company. Faye read Rimbaud. She read Blake, sometimes aloud from a paperback while they were walking across campus together. What immoral hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Doesn't that make you want to turn your brain inside out? When she smiled, her mouth crimped down at either end, which somehow still looked like a smile. One afternoon, at Faye's suggestion, they stood side by side in adjoining shower stalls and washed their hair with raw eggs they'd whipped up in a plastic tumbler. They shared a jar of mayonnaise, scooping it out with their fingers and massaging it into their roots, then wrapped the tops of their heads in tin foil. When they walked barefoot back to Faye's room, their towels knotted just under their armpits, they passed a pair of waxy-looking girls who were probably stoned and who muttered, "Take us to your leader," and "Make way for the lezzies." "Don't let them bother you," Faye said, putting Donovan onto her turntable. "They're just jealous because they have no friends." Celia sat down on Faye's bed and said, "I'm not bothered." She was. After enduring a year of people singing her name to her because that song, Cecilia, just wouldn't go away, she hated hearing even the most benign remark tossed off by a stranger. And most people were strangers, which was fine, really, because it clicked with her ever-ready state of guardedness, particularly around other girls. But Faye was the opposite. Around Faye, Celia unclenched. "I got egg in my eye while we were showering," she said. "Do you think I could catch salmonella that way?" "You get that from chickens, not eggs. Eggs are perfect. They're like the ovaries of the animal kingdom." The mayonnaise is dripping. A milky rivulet was running down the side of Celia's face. "That happens," Faye said. "Just use your towel." She was squatting down with her back to Celia, reading the album's jacket. Just as Celia undid her towel and wiped her cheek, Faye turned around. "Do you think Donovan's better looking than Mickey?" "Oh," Celia covered herself again. "I think they're both handsome, just maybe in different ways." "Donovan's so pretty, he almost looks like a girl." "You can't say that about Mickey, though he is pretty gorgeous." She sat down on the narrow bed beside Celia, then lay back in her arm with her arms crossed behind her head and her legs bent. "Rub my calves?" Celia used both hands, rolling the muscles between her palms. "If you could have one thing, just one thing in the entire world," Faye asked, "what would it be?" "A mansion," Celia said. "No, that's stupid. What would you do with all that space? You don't even want kids. Still, to have a cook and a pool man and someone who rang a bell at dinner would be something." "A farm," she said instead. "I don't really care about farming. I just like those farm noises you hear. Chickens clucking, horses doing that horse breathing. What about you?" "Universal love," Faye said, gazing up at the ceiling. "For each and every being, no matter what their sex is, no matter what color they are. Two legs, four legs, whatever. Universal love." "That's wonderful," Celia said, embarrassed by her own selfishness. Faye led them both to the mirror, removed Celia's foil, and began guiding a brush through Celia's hair. Celia watched Faye, watching her. "Mickey and I are talking about establishing a love haven after college," Faye said. "A love haven?" "In the woods somewhere. A place where people could come and build their own cabin, or even just put up a tent. A place where they could expand their minds and live in unanimous oneness with the universe." Celia thought unanimous oneness was redundant, but said, "That sounds ideal. You could come live with us there." Faye's free hand was resting on her bare shoulder. The other was still guiding the brush, though by now Celia's hair was slicked back and aligned, and the brush was acting more as a scalp massager than anything else. "Would that be all right with Mickey?" Faye's eyes met hers in the mirror, and she leaned her head, which was still wrapped in foil and looked like a giant Hershey's kiss, in close to Celia's. In a softer voice, she said, "Mickey's like me. He loves love." Celia supposed she did too. The hand on her shoulder had moved to her chin, and Faye guided her head to the side until Celia was staring at her profile. Then she turned her own head, and their noses nearly touched. "Do you trust me?" "Yes," Celia said. "And you're copacetic? I mean, you want to expand your mind, right?" "I think it's important." "Would you die for me?" "Oh, yes, why not? Yes, I would." "You smell like a sandwich," Faye said, and then kissed her. Not a peck, but nothing that was over with too quickly, either. Had their tongues touched? Celia couldn't remember now. She only knew for certain that the embrace had never happened again. It was the only same-sex kiss of her life, and for as unexpected and even startling as it had been, the experience wasn't unpleasant. Far from it, she'd felt adored, desired, even with a deranged "die for me" question. She'd never received subsequent word of Faye's and Mickey's love haven. The sea ray and the deck with the jacuzzi would suggest they'd shifted their priorities somewhere along the way. But the fact that they were still married after all these years was touching. Leroy was a small town. She might have coasted right through it if she hadn't been paying attention to the signs. Her plan, and she doubted that it would work, was to find a local phone book and look up the name Noonan. If they weren't listed, that would be that. Or maybe she would drive around a bit, keeping an eye out for a house that had a boat parked alongside it and a newish-looking deck with a gazebo. Having a destination mattered more than the outcome, she decided. Having a destination meant not having to think about other things. The plan played out with surprising ease. A woman working at a 7-Eleven produced a phone book upon request. The Noonans were listed, and she told Celia how to get there. As it turned out, the Noonan house was less than 2 miles away. "You can't miss it," the woman said. Celia thanked her. The tree-lined road she turned onto was potholed and winding. She drove 1.75 miles, according to the odometer, then started looking for house numbers. There were few houses and even fewer numbers to be found. One of the metal mailboxes along the road appeared to have been smashed in with a bat. She drove a bit further, the car dipping and bucking with the potholes, and she was on the verge of turning back when the trees thinned out and a clearing opened up on the left side of the road. She spotted another mailbox, this one unscathed and made of green plastic. The name Noonan stuck to it in a climbing sweep of gold on black letters. The house didn't look like a house. It looked like a large box of corrugated metal, painted white and streaked with ribbons of rust. It had a door and a series of windows punched into it, an empty carport attached to one side, and a pair of long wooden beams angling out from the other, as if propping up a wall that might otherwise collapse. She turned in at the mailbox and trundled up a gravel driveway, but halfway between the road and the house, the gravel gave way to grass. She could just make out a flattened path in the yard leading up to the carport, but to have gone any further than the gravel seemed rude. She stopped the car, turned off the engine, and peered at the house. No deck that she could see, no gazebo, certainly no boat. Wrong Noonans, she thought. A pair of signs were fixed to the front of the house with duct tape. "Vote no on Proposition 9, read one. "Support our troops," read the other. A trio of children, two girls around 10 or 11, and a younger and much smaller boy, were running circles in the front yard around what appeared to be an oversized beanbag chair, their exhalations visible in the cold air. Celia got out of the car. "Excuse me," she said, approaching the children. "Are you Noonans?" One of the girls stopped short and seemed to notice her for the first time. She screwed her face up, crossed her eyes, and twisted her arms around Joe Cocker style as she repeated an approximation of what Celia had said. "Are you Noonan?" "Are you Noonans?" Celia said more carefully. The girl's twisting and facial contortions only doubled. She pitched her head sideways and uttered, "Are you Noonan?" "Are you?" Celia paused to indicate all three of them. "Noonans. Is that your last name, Noonan?" "Are you Noonan?" the girl yelled, and launched into a fit, spinning and gesticulating around her sister and brother, both of whose shoulders were wobbling, bobbing with laughter. "Are you Noonan? Are you Noonan?" Celia folded her arms and said, "I have all day, young lady." "I have all day, yole," the girl barked, and it occurred to Celia that she might be mentally challenged. If so, how horrible that anyone would give her a hard time, and how barbaric that the other two were laughing at her. This was how they spent their days, she imagined, sitting around making fun of their handicapped sister, saying things she would parrot, and making fun of her, in the freezing cold, no less. But then the door set into the front of the house swung inward with a rusty shriek, and a gaunt old woman in a bathrobe appeared, framed in the corrugated metal. Her hair was gray and looked emblazed with static electricity. Her eyes had an irritated squint. "What was I doing?" she asked, scowling at the three children. The girl who'd been hollering fell silent and straightened up. None of them answered the old woman. "What was I doing?" she snapped in a louder voice, then stepped onto the concrete slab of front porch and pulled a pair of sunglasses from a pocket in her robe. "That's right, napping. I was napping. But I'm not napping now, am I? I'm standing up and feeling sick to death, having gotten no sleep last night because one of you had to have an earache." She made the air quotes with her fingers and then put on the sunglasses. The mouthy girl pointed to Celia. In a perfectly normal voice, she said, "It was her fault." "It most certainly was not my fault," Celia retorted. "I was merely asking your last name." The woman eyed the Buick in the yard. She eyed Celia, or one would assume. It was hard to tell through the sunglasses. And after a moment, she asked, "What's your gig?" "My gig? What are you doing here?" "Asking if they were Noonan," Celia said. "One of your daughters was very rude to me." "Please," the woman said, "they're not my kids. They're my grandkids." I'm sorry if I'm inconveniencing anyone, Celia said, but is their last name Noonan? It says Noonan on the mailbox. Their last name's Pratt. I see. She turned to squint at the mailbox, and when she looked back, the old woman had a cigarette going, as if she'd been holding it the entire time. When she sucked on it, the divots in her cheeks looked deep enough to sink a thumb into. Well, I was looking for someone I used to know, but I think I have the wrong house, so I'll just... Are you a census taker? The old woman asked, stepping down into the yard. The sunglasses, combined with an overly careful manner of walking, made her appear blind. No, Celia held out her hand. I'm Celia... She didn't even want to utter the two syllables that comprised the last name she'd used for the past 10 years. On the spot, she decided to go with her first husband's name. I'm Celia Reed. Noonan, the old woman said, pointing her thumb toward her own chest instead of returning the handshake. Oh, the pieces started coming together. I know your daughter. You know my daughter. I used to, in college. Well, if you know where she is now, I wish you'd tell her to come get her kids. They're going to put me in the ground. The woman frowned in a way that drew creases down to her neck. She told me she had to find herself, as if she didn't know where in the hell she was, and that was 4 months ago. Is she dead? Alive? Abducted by little green men? I have no idea. I just want her to come get these kids. Celia peered at the downward set of the woman's mouth. Faye? Yeah? The gray hair, the withered face, the composite, fragile look of her. Had the cigarettes done all that? Celia had never felt so thankful for having quit years ago. Faye, it's me, Celia Dugan. You just said your last name was Reed. It was. I was married to a man who passed away, and then I got married again. It doesn't matter. You remember me, don't you? Faye was standing between her and the children. Over her robed shoulder, Celia saw the girls patting down one end of the beanbag and then lifting the boy up and setting him on it. Faye, Celia said, we used to know each other. I used to know Mickey. How is he? Faye took a drag and exhaled. The frown had deepened. The hand holding the cigarette had begun to tremble. Where are you on Proposition 9? One of the girls was standing near the beanbag now. The other one was positioned herself a good distance away. Go, the one cried, and the other ran, leapt, and steered her body toward the opposite end of the beanbag from where her little brother sat. When she landed, the boy was propelled into an arc some 5 feet in the air. Aye, he hollered, and then landed hard on the ground, chest first. Oh, Celia said, bringing a hand to her mouth, is that child all right? They're made of steel, Faye said without turning around. They're from hell. I've got a good memory for names and faces, but maybe with all the names you've had, you're undergoing some kind of identity crisis. Maybe you're bipolar. Either way, I have to tell you, I remember us, Celia Dugan, and you look nothing like her. Nothing like her? What was that supposed to mean? That she'd aged so dramatically, so drastically, that she could have been a different person now? This from a woman who looked like a deflated plasma bag. Celia glanced again at the children to see if the little one had gotten up. He had. He was standing away from his sister, staring at the ground in front of him and holding his chest with both hands. I am her, she told Faye. I mean, I'm me, and I've had an awful time lately, a terrible time. I've never been lower in my life. Everything's fallen apart, and I feel on the verge of something drastic. So much for presenting a glamorized version of herself. Faye puffed and offered a slight shrug. Join the club. Listen, I'm a busy person, okay? I don't have time for this sort of nonsense. Busy? Celia asked. You were taking a nap when I got here. No one was even watching these children, and it's freezing outside. Grandchildren, Faye corrected. You're kind of a bitch, aren't you? She had a point. Celia was crossing a line, criticizing where it wasn't her place. After all, the two of them hadn't seen each other in nearly 40 years. Would you take off your glasses and look at me? The twins were rolling around now like a pair of lovers in the beanbag. A little boy was still holding his chest. Oozing smoke, Faye sighed and removed her sunglasses. Her eyes were crazed with veins, and she stared for a prolonged series of moments that Celia was tempted to look away, but didn't. It was almost as if some sort of challenge were at stake between them. Finally, Faye said, I don't know you, and put the glasses back on. Yes, you do, Celia said. I don't. What did I ever do to make you act so mean, Celia asked. For God's sake, I used to worship you. Don't know you, Faye said again. Figure out where you stand on Proposition 9, and when you've got that figured out, vote no. Celia huffed with disbelief. She clutched her purse and gazed at the surrounding trees, the immovable gray sky, the rusted corrugated house. How would I know about your family but from the Christmas letters you send me, she asked. How would I know about your children, the whatever it is, divisional manager and the architect? She paused, remembering. Where's this deck and gazebo you're so proud of, anyway? Where's the boat? Faye had started back toward the house. As Celia watched, she stopped and, in what seemed to be slow motion, turned herself around. Her jaw was jutting forward and pushed slightly to one side. She wasn't smoking now, but her cheeks were sucked in, recessed beneath the sunglasses, and she looked terrifying, an angel of death. All three children were staring at her. With her face held steady, she made her way back to the spot where she'd just been standing. "Now you goddamn well listen to me, and you listen good," she uttered, leaning into Celia. "The deck is there." She stabbed a finger toward the beams angled against one side of the house. "The gazebo is there." Her finger moved slightly to the left. "And the boat," she swung her arm over and pointed to some spot near the vicinity of the carport, "is right goddamn there. And you're in theater now." "That's right. Everything's coming up goddamn roses. Are you copacetic with that, Sherlock?" Not being able to see her eyes was somehow worse than peering into them. "I am," Celia said. "Good. So why don't you get the hell out of here? You're giving me a goddamn pain in the ass. Thank you very much."
Thank you. I do want to point out, here's just one story again as an example, not available in stores. And in fact, while some other literary magazines are occasionally available in stores, the fact is the only way to support a magazine you love is to subscribe to it. So when you find a magazine that speaks to you, please do subscribe. It's really the only way to ensure that they will be able to continue bringing you literature that speaks to you. So I'll give this back to Hannah. And now introduce our next selection, a poetry offering from Aufgabe. So I now call to the stage, not really stage, is it? To the podium, Paul Foster Johnson, to tell us a little bit about Aufgabe. There he is, and introduce our poet.
Thanks so much. Thank you to CLMP, such a wonderful and supportive organization, and to the New York Public Library. So I just wanted to start out with a pronunciation guide for the journal. It was fabulously inflected by Jeffrey, but in case you missed it, and it's usually a good icebreaker when I talk to people about the journal, but I want to do it en masse so you can all impress your friends. The emphasis is on the first syllable, Aufgabe, and the last syllable is kind of like a schwa. So, and in case you forget, there are pins at the back which help you do it on your own. So in case you're wondering where the title of the journal comes from, it's from the Walter Benjamin essay Task of the Translator, and it means task or homework, so it's in the title in German. The journal was founded by E. Tracy Grinnell in 2001 as the Journal of Litmus Press, which publishes U.S. poetry and poetry in translation. And each issue of the journal, true to what the word means, it features a section of poetry translated into English from a particular country. And so the forthcoming issue, which is issue number 7, which is about to appear, will have a section of Italian poetry in translation. And what makes the journal unique is that it also, in addition to the translation section, it features a section of current U.S. poetry, in addition to some essays, notes, and talks. So it's really great, the cultural sort of interaction that takes place within the cover of the journal. But the best way to get a sense of what the journal's like is to stop at the back of the room and check it out, and check out some of our Aufgabe ephemera. And so our representative reader tonight, Evelyn Riley, is actually in issue number 7, which will be out in about a month. And she came to poetry by sort of an unusual path. She studied to be a biologist, and you can see that engagement persisting in her writing and also her editorial and curatorial work. You can see her publications in her bio, but in addition to that, she's the co-editor of an eco-language reader with Brenda Ijima. And during her time curating Segway, she organized a panel with Brenda on eco-poetics. But her interdisciplinary approach is not just limited to science, and actually her contribution to the forthcoming issue is kind of a sociology of the poetry reading as a form. So I won't say any more in case she's reading that piece tonight, but it's really the way she gets into the sort of tics and thought process of a poetry reader. It's kind of amazing, so look out for that. As editors, we're really engaged by Evelyn's work and how technically accomplished it is and how it also reflects the personal and political context that it exists in. So please welcome Evelyn Riley.
Thank you, Paul, for the introduction, and thanks to the organizers of this event. And I also want to thank Tracy Grinnell, who is Paul's co-editor, in putting out the really fabulous Afgaba, which does have the issue that's upcoming does have this pretty great section on Italian poetry and translation, so I encourage you to connect with the journal. How's the sound here? Is that working pretty good? In the past year, I've been compelled to write almost entirely about styrofoam. Once I started, it just seemed to attach to itself all kinds of things that I'm interested in, notions of kind of literary versus ecological, immortality, synthetic substances, the idea of so-called authentic versus faux materials, nostalgia, kitsch, the problem with nature poetry at the present time. So it just kind of kept going. So I thought that I would read mainly from that today. The work as a whole has an epigraph from D.H. Lawrence: "Build your little ark and fill it with little cakes." And also, since he's here, I just want to thank James Sherry for being supportive of this work. The first section I'll read is a kind of invocation to the muse. It's called "Hence Mystical Cosmetic Over Sunset Landfill." And the phrase "mystical cosmetic" is borrowed from Barbara Guest. "Hence Mystical Cosmetic Over Sunset Landfill. Answer: styrofoam deathlessness. Question: how long does it take? And all the time singing in my throat, little dead French lady in your eternity saddle, hat 59% acrylic, 41% mode acrylic, ornamental trim, 76% viscose rayon, 24% polyamide, and holding a vial enwrapped. Enter 8, 9, 13, 14, 17, ethyl nyl, 13 methyl, 7, 8, 9, 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, octahydrocyclopentadiol, aka environmental sources of hormonal activity. Side effects include tenderness, dizziness, and aberrations of the vision. Oh, please just pass the pass out juice now. Answer: it is a misconception that materials biodegrade in a meaningful time frame. Answer: thought to be composters, landfills are actually vast mummifiers of waste and waste's companions, low, stunning, all color, heap-like, and manifold of foam. One, a mass of fine bubbles on the surface of a liquid. Two, a material in a lightweight cellular form resulting from the introduction of gas bubbles. Three, frothy saliva. Four, the sea, lit, which can be molded into almost anything and cousin to all things artistic. Kristen J., a low oven and a watchful eye, turns bits of used plastic meat trays into keychain ornaments. Monica T., soft and satisfying for infant teething if you first freeze. Posted 10/11/2007 at thriftyfun.com, hosted by PFPG, the Plastics Food Service Packaging Group. All this formation and deformation, and barely able to see beyond the dense congregation of species successful in environments where the diversity of plants and animals has been radically diminished. For all averred, we had killed the bird, enter albatross stand-in of choice. hence this mood of moods, this fucked flux lux crux, broken piece of lamp garbage, sunset 400 lux, LCD computer screen 300 lux, full moon 0.25 lux, starlight 0.0005 lux, all that falls outside the spectrum, Antarctic file cherubim, and dearest docent, holding hands for the briefest moment of shared materiality among long-term heritage styrene. Gee, this stationary particulate cloud actually improves the sunset. What the sea brought, poly, flotsam, faux, foam, and phloam, a kind of slime with polystyrene beads in it that can be used to transform almost any object into a unique work of art. So this section is then followed by about five or six others with titles like Bear Meat Polystyrene, and there's one called Daffodil Gondola Polystyrene, which came from thinking about Wordsworth's idea of the sublime, and Ezra Ra, which was inspired by Ezra Pound's line, "And the ant's forefoot shall save you." But the other section that I thought I'd read tonight is called The Whiteness of the Foam. And there's a collagist aspect to all this work, so you may be recognizing certain fragments, of course, including this title, The Whiteness of the Foam. The opposite of snow, but of like white, the polymer est ect thermoplastic, which becomes hot and pliable when heated without change in its intrinsic properties, molded, white upon white, whitest, whitish, whiteness, est, est, ex, ex, to stand clothed in supposed flesh-colored crayon, to ride on the heat of your own melting dark marker, to melt on the foam of your own molding, counter-shaded, bilaterally symmetrical embodiment of environmental cue dynamics. While the flow's a stage the crows use, a vehicle of predation, and a platform to assess the damages, having built our little ark and reduced our dependence on others as a positive goal. As that which suddenly appears just in time for our arrival on the next foothold, white ears above the flood melt, warm nostrils reddened through the cool milkiness, such vast accessory albino beauty. But the Dawn Princess made no report of a possible collision. See www.princesstours.com/legal/environmental-policy/index, even though many aboard said they had heard a resounding thud. Nor to bear witness to the common experience of all fall, to bring to bear this apoplexy, apocalypse, and incantation, this devastation, deflection, invocation, this reflex, context, perplex, perspex, an impact modified acrylic of utmost clarity and lucid lucidity. Luciferin, a substance found in the cells of certain organisms that upon oxidation emits light. Nanofuel price list, 1 milligram, $55 per amber screw cap vial. 10 milligrams, $450 per amber screw cap vial. 100 milligrams, $4,050 per amber screw cap vial. All in this uneternal, defrosted desolateness, where the solvent properties of our solvent imprints admit not even the cheerful greenness of complete decay. Yet still driving forth in blue carbon beneath this white blanket debris galaxy picture, almost any mark way too permanent, having been pieces of cosmos once. Polymerization of the reaction beloved, catalyst for the reaction cherished, product of the reaction tenderest, aftermath of the reaction, dearest. Autofill this form for you. Now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and read something quite different that I've never read before, but because AFGABA published it, I thought I'd do that. And now that I'm in this room, I realize the ending is probably particularly unsuitable for the setting, but I guess I'm just going to read it anyway. This microphone perhaps puts you too close to my breathing. All this fidgeting and squirming, what I hate about readings. The hormonal level of the room, the relative amount of audience abuse. So you may just have to entertain yourself, be more or less on your own. But it will only go on for so long. There's nothing more self-punishing than an avant-garde crowd. All those knowing titters. I first heard them at a screening, note the word screening, of Le Chien et de Loup. There they were, the titters. A sign, I think, of quote, knowing, end quote. But people are polite generally, and a lot of poetry is just venting. And the nervous titters are sometimes just the desire to belong, a kind of testing of the atmosphere of belonging. But why not laughter? Why always titters and not laughter? Who would ever go out to titter, a kind of inferior laughter? Then there are the cell phones. Sometimes I hide in mine just to pass the time, to try to get time to move when it has become annoying. But of course, even the most useless calls are saturated with time. Pretty much the same kind of time as I'm now taking of yours. About 3 seconds per line. That's my meter. That's the meter I have running. While I'm talking about time and anxiety and poetry, anxiety and discomfort and poetry, that repetition took about 4 seconds of your time. Now I'll try to be positive about this usurped time of yours, which I've decided is mine. Even though, of course, other people enter into it. Other people. Other people sound so different from, quote, the other, sound more irritating and annoying, less exotic, less grand, less ethically demanding. More like you and me, in fact, like the people immediately around, the people who make you feel you are either a better or a worse person, because that's really how we define these things, a pretty faulty system, but there it is. How much easier to feel warm and loving toward, quote, the other. Not the real thing, of course, just the hypothetical. Something to do with why people can be charming to groups and cold one-on-one. Why some are insincere generally, but can be quite unexpectedly generous. Why some say they love the planet, but dislike human beings. Why someone says, the zoos are concentration camps. But does that demean the experience of people who were in the camps? Or is it not the zoos, but the slaughterhouses that were concentration camps? And the zoos are more an example of internment. For in the camps, people were treated like animals. And in the slaughterhouses, animals are treated like meat. But does it really demean humans to compare them to animals? Or is it the, quote, treatment that's the problem? The cruelty, which is our natural treatment of animals, even though the animal is the only part of us that's embraceable. The rest being purely speculative. But the butcher is convivial. The butcher is a loving family person. And family people are less selfish. They are living for others. And there is nothing like blood to bind us together. And the fisherman practices an ancient art. The word art makes it beautiful, even though it is seeped in blood. And the nets glimmer in the moonlight. And Jesus said to his disciples, I will make you fishers of men. But what about the hooks in the lips and gills? What about those little inverse curving prongs that make it impossible to remove the hooks without tearing the skin? When Jesus said fishers of men, did he deliberately exclude women? When he said you are my rock to Peter, did he mean that rocks were male? Is the Pope a male rock? And what about the jobs lost if we become less sadistic toward fish? What about the American dream? What about ordinary people? Who is an ordinary person? Does even using the word ordinary imply that we, you and I, think we aren't? Aren't we just ordinary people who are trying to connect with each other? Or are we squirming, not connecting? Are we squirming in a connecting manner? Are we collaboratively squirming? Are we squirming in a shared communal space? Or are we just here having a poem together? How is that different from having other things together? Is it more like having sex or having dinner together? If sex, how so? And if dinner, why not sex? Or maybe it's more like having fun. Maybe we are deluding ourselves and it is only fun. What's so bad about that? Why so serious? You, the consumer of poems, do you find mine original? By saying consumer, am I saying something political? Do you believe in originality, or is this just a kind of passing around, a sort of redistribution of the communal stuff of words? Are you considering walking out and would like a cue as to how long this will go on? Are you thinking, I only came here for the other ones, and now I'm stuck? Would you like a drink? Is there any alcohol in this place? Are you thinking, why do I keep doing this to myself? A whole life, and I haven't gotten anywhere, really. Thinking it's amazing how time goes by. Is this how I'm going to grow old? And what about money? And what if I get sick? And what does she care, you might think, you who are wondering, is she putting me on? Thinking maybe you could do this so much better. Or so-and-so has already done it 100 times. Or thinking, why doesn't she go back to those poems I liked so much last year? Or maybe you never liked them, but maybe secretly you don't like poems at all and are just a masochist. Maybe all poets are basically masochists and all audiences for poetry are just assemblies of masochists. Or maybe this isn't, quote, real poetry and you actually do like the, quote, real stuff. So what's the use? And if there are uses, does that mean there are abuses? Isn't this where I started? Am I abusing you? And maybe it's not you, but quote, a you, and I'm just using, quote, your time. There's so much we could be doing in this same slot of time, things of real, quote, social benefit. Now I've definitely taken your time. Your time is disappearing. I've been collecting it all along. It's so strange, all this other people's time. It's so strange that there are other people out there treating each other like humans instead of like plants and animals and viruses and fungi, which might really be better, if still pretty bad, maybe a little bit less. Now, how to get this to stop? How to find some convention of stopping? Do you mind if I give that up? Maybe just end so we can let some others in. The rats, for example, who are waiting behind the walls so they can come out when the strange behavior is done and breathe a little in the evening air, open their delicate olfactory pouches to expose the scent glands that make living such a captivating brew of urine and sex and weather and food. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before our final selection, a couple more quick thank yous. We are very, very fortunate to be in a state, and I mean as in geography, of enlightened funders who care about literature. I don't know if you all realize how lucky we really are to have a state arts council and a city funding agency that fund literature specifically. That's rather unique, even in California. We do not have this funding for literature, so you're lucky to be here. So I do want to thank the New York State Council and the Arts Estate Agency and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs for helping us present these free programs to you. What they get out of this are the survey forms filled out that you see in front of you, and it's how we continue to get funding. So please do take a moment to take the tiny pencils at the end of the program in front of you and to fill them out. It takes just a moment. You can take the little tiny pencil home with you as your keepsake of this evening, and we will have something to show them that this really, really happened. I also want to give a final thank you to Tasha Sorensen over there from CLMP, who curated tonight's program, and did it particularly well because what better way than to end with Epiphany? And now to introduce our final selection from Epiphany magazine, Carol Nielsen, editor. Carol, come on up.
Okay, I hadn't actually planned to give remarks about Epiphany as a magazine, but I'll do my best. Epiphany was started in 2003 by my editor, Willard Cook, over there in the far corner. He was teaching fiction writing workshops at New York University in the Continuing Education Program, Department of Writing and Speech, and he was just seeing such good work in his classes, and he felt that there should be a place to publish good work and more of it. And I think that's why we're all here celebrating that. 2 years ago, the magazine actually went independent, and I actually have a bit of a personal debt to Epiphany because my essay appeared in the first hard copy, which is in the back. Oh, I see our current issue is also in the back now. And it went on to be named as a notable essay in Best American Essays. So thank you, Epiphany. Sorry, I'm speaking improperly into this microphone. Last year, Willard asked me to take over as nonfiction editor, and the first story, when we sat down and had coffee on a cold winter day, he said, "Do you have any story ideas?" And I said, "Yes, Anna Steegman. Her work is very powerful, as you'll see, and funny." And I was so pleased that he liked her work as much as I do. Since then, her piece actually appeared in the spring online issue and our winter 2008 book that also included Nobel laureate Derek Walcott, who I've just now learned this evening was included in the Pushcart Prize. So a little bit about Anna. Since her piece came out in the winter issue, she let me know that her memoir was entered into the Amazon contest, and it was awarded semi-finalist for best breakout novel on Amazon.com, and should have won. But Anna, a little bit about her. Anna was born in Germany, and she's lived in New York City since 1980. She worked as an actress and as a psychotherapist until deciding to make writing her priority. She has been published in Epiphany, as well as the New York Times, Sick, Promethean, 138 Journal, and German newspapers. Wising Up Press has accepted several of her stories, forthcoming in anthologies, and her translations have been published by W.W. Norton, Absinthe, and Dimension Squared. She teaches writing at City College of New York, where she received her MA in creative writing. Thanks.
Okay. Here we go. I actually read better without the glasses, so can you hear me? Harlem, even at its worst, has always been good to me. The first friend I made in New York after leaving my home in Germany lived in Harlem. We met in '82 at an audition at La Mama. I was excited when Dana Jackson invited me to her house. She lived with her mother in East Harlem, not far from where my favorite writer, James Baldwin, was raised. In my German guidebook, Manhattan ended at 96th Street, and foreign visitors were warned not to venture beyond because they might not leave Harlem or Washington Heights alive. But I wasn't afraid of Harlem. I already knew Harlem from James Baldwin's novels, short stories, and essays that I had read in the German translation. As soon as I emerged from the number 2 train at the corner of 125th Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, the air was full of danger and menace. The only white person on the street, I held my head high and walked with confidence east for a block, then turned right into what Baldwin had called wide, filthy, hostile Fifth Avenue. I looked for the grocery store's Jewish proprietor who had given the Baldwin family credit, the shoe repair store's Negro proprietor, the bi-black street corner meetings, and the holy rollers Baldwin had described. I hoped to find the fireside Pentecostal assembly where James got his start as a youthful preacher. Instead, I found blocks of abandoned and burned-out buildings that looked like Germany at the end of World War II. Street vendors aggressively hawked their wares, and black Israelite preachers pontificated to their street flock. One of them, looking extraterrestrial in his shiny silver headband and belt, suddenly spewed hatred in my direction. Whites are the incarnation of evil. God will wipe out all the Christians and Muslims. Only we are his chosen people. I walked faster. Shady characters lurked in doorways. Young men offered me drugs. A good number of people had collabs on the pavement, strung out on potent liquor or drugs. I was relieved to finally arrive safely at Dana's home. Dana's mother felt sorry for me, all alone in New York, so far away from my own mother, and adopted me for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and many Sunday dinners. On my first visit, I stared in disbelief at the abundance of food. Unsure about what to do with all those knives and forks, I waited for Miss Jackson to start. She wore a chic flower print dress that clung to her curvaceous body. Her hair was done in the latest Jerry Curl fashion, and the bright orange of her lipstick and perfectly manicured nails matched the colors of her dress. So different from my mother, who always wore an apron or a house dress. Never a stylish dress like Miss Jackson. My mother hated makeup. She had been indoctrinated by Hitler's youth organization for girls. A German girl is a pure girl. A pure girl doesn't smoke or paint her face. Only whores do. Child, are you hungry? Miss Jackson asked me. Then she folded her hands neatly in front of her chest. Dear Lord, she said, thank you for all the blessings you have bestowed upon us. And thank you for bringing us this nice visitor from Germany. Overcome, I turned beet red. I was 26, and no one had called me child in a very long time. At home, saying grace was simply going through the motions, mumbling the words without thinking. Miss Jackson made up her own prayer. She spoke like a poet and infused each word with deep emotion. An atheist since fourth grade, I was ready to join her flock. I was taken with Miss Jackson's grace, hospitality, and her amazing culinary talents. She introduced me to new foods, black-eyed peas, mustard greens, okra, and best of all, sweet potato pie. Her colored greens looked and smelled similar to my mother's grünkohl, but tasted so much better. Her smothered pork chops were the best I've ever had. I found that black people, like the Germans, devoured pig's feet, ham hocks, and tripe. What we called Sauermagen, they called chitlins and maw. Our drinking habits, however, were worlds apart. The Jacksons did not drink beer or wine with dinner. They drank ginger ale with their meals and strange alcoholic concoctions before or after. Miss Jackson taught me about black history, about Harlem as the capital of black America. The excitement of the civil rights movement, the riots and the devastation caused by drugs that followed. The middle class moved to the suburbs and left nothing but poor people behind. Harlem turned into a slum. A supervisor at AT&T, she purchased her brownstone on East 122nd Street during that time and was very proud to have made it on her own. Smart woman, buy low and sell high. A legendary beauty, Miss Jackson had enjoyed many suitors in her youth, but never married. She had banished Dana's father, the sperm donor, from her life. He drank too much and was a heap of trouble. She had a steady boyfriend, but would not let him move in with her. Why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free? Hank, the owner of a trucking company, was a perfect gentleman. He took her to fine restaurants, Broadway musicals, and weekend trips to Atlantic City. For her birthday, he bought her serious jewelry. He let her pick out his clothes at Sims and agreed to have the rims of his hats taken in, since he, a native of South Carolina, looked too country for her taste. I thought of Miss Jackson as a feminist icon and tried to follow her advice. Don't let a man treat your ass like a comfort station. My mother, afraid to be on her own, had stayed in a loveless marriage with an irresistible husband. She could have learned a thing or two from Miss Jackson's chutzpah. In Berlin, I lived in a spacious, sunny apartment with a beautiful desk and hundreds of books. But in New York, my room was as sparse as a prison cell. Leaving Harlem, the warmth and comfort of the Jackson's home was tough. I was not looking forward to my dingy Alphabet City sublet. Emboldened by all the whiskey sours, I rejected Dana's offer to walk me to the subway. Don't worry, I'll take a cab. There were no yellow cabs in Harlem, but I was hoping for a livery cab to come my way. For a long time, I waved my arms frantically, but all the cars passed me by. When I got fortunate and one car stopped, the driver, a mean expression on his face, sped away as soon as I tried to open the rear door. Sometime later, as pathetic as a dog caught in the rain, I rang the Jackson's doorbell again. Dana smiled at my foolishness, then escorted me to the street and hailed a cab. The drivers always stopped for her. When I was 9, the newspapers brought disturbing images into our living room. Young black children marching through the streets of Birmingham had been knocked unconscious by blasts of water jets and mauled by German shepherds unleashed by the police. Feeling sorry for the little girl my age in the picture, I became a champion of justice for black people and sent a letter to John F. Kennedy. I begged him to do something about the grave injustice in the United States of America. Later in high school, I joined a radical students group and got arrested for plastering the town with flyers proclaiming Solidarität mit dem Schwarzen Panther. I admired many black artists, Miles Davis and Sarah Vaughan, Langston Hughes and James Baldwin. Black people seemed to possess a greater capacity for emotion and compassion. In Germany, I had been surrounded by anger, envy, and bitterness, but sadness was a forbidden feeling. You pretended that everything was fine, that you were brave and tough, that you didn't need help or sympathy. You let no one know that you cried yourself to sleep at night. The concerts of American blues musicians I attended as a teenager showed me a different way of being in the world. Champion Jack Dupree, Big Joe Williams, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Joe Turner and all the others made it okay to moan and groan, to wail and cry. They made it okay to be human, warts and all. In 86, I married a handsome black man who had moved to New York from Baltimore. He owned his own fashion company and lived in a posh 17-story doorman building on the Upper West Side, where he was the only black tenant. Many evenings, attempting to return home from his Soho store or a downtown party, empty taxis sped us by. I remember leaving the Jackson's house and not being able to get a cab on 125th Street. Those drivers must have been retaliating for all the times they, their mothers, or their sisters were left out in the rain. When Miss Jackson passed away, I had no reason to go back to Harlem. Dana and I drifted apart. She sold a house and moved to the East Village, took on a pen name, and supported her artist life with the money from the sale. Her investment paid off. She became an accomplished playwright, portrayed the black and white divide in her writing, and performed her work in a raw and unsettling manner. The public and critics took notice. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and won an Obie Award for her one-woman show. I did not stay with theater. I got a real job as a school counselor instead. Inside the school, teachers and students were safe from the gang wars and shootouts in the streets. We did not venture out to get lunch at the roti stand for fear of not making it back alive. Most of the students were Haitian. Gladimir, age 10, was my favorite. He had lost his mother to cancer and was mad at his father for bringing his girlfriend to live with them while his mother lay dying in the hospital. Gladimir's fantasy was to be adopted by me. We'd live happily ever after in a big suburban home, drive to the mall in a station wagon, and go on camping trips. He was disappointed that I didn't own a car or a house like the white people on TV, but stayed my biggest fan. He called me the light-skinned lady and told his classmates, "Miss Stegman, she's not white, she's German."
Sorry.
What I forgot to say is that actually I had to cut out one third, so there might be like some jarring transitions in this. The next part is I cut out two pages. A friend of mine who was born in Harlem, Holland, invited me to come to a tour in Hamilton Heights, and I had never been aware of Hamilton Heights and that part of Harlem at all, so she took me on a house and garden tour, and this is the end of the tour now. The grand finale of the tour was our visit to the St. Nick's pub. Once we walked down the steps under the red awning, we found ourselves in a delightful dive. The bartender, around 65, with an impressive wig and too much pancake makeup, flirted with all her male customers. Many of them took an interest in us. Bayard Jones, old enough to be my grandfather, bought us a drink. Look at the photographs on the wall. Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Charlie Parker. They all hung out here in the old days, he said. You are kidding, Agnes and I said in unison. What about Billie Holiday, I asked. Billie, a gardenia in her hair, looked melancholy lovely in the faded photograph on the wall. Billie got her start here, Bayard said. Remember, St. Nick's Pub has been in business since 1940. How I wished I could have met Billie Holiday here at St. Nick's Pub. I imagined her getting off the stage, sitting down next to Bayard and ordering herself a whiskey. Bayard turned to me. So how do you ladies like Sugar Hill? I finished my second beer and declared enthusiastically, I love it here. I think I could live here. Agnes rolled her eyes and crinkled her nose at my foolishness. You'll be back downtown in no time, she said. My marriage to the handsome black man did not last. I found a handsome Ukrainian man instead. Living downtown with my new love in one room for 8 years choked my creativity. I had given up on theater, and then I gave up on writing too. My English wasn't good enough, and my German wasn't great any longer. Anyhow, how could I be a writer if I didn't even have my own desk? I yearned to have my own desk in a way some women yearn for a child. It was irrational and all-consuming. Miss Jackson had told me over and over, only a fool pays rent. At 45, I did not want to live like a college student any longer. I haunted stationery stores and bought ink pots, writing paraphernalia, and decorative objects for a desk I had yet to own. I started to investigate foreclosures, the only way to realize my real estate dreams on my salary. In November 98, in the week before Thanksgiving, the New York Times advertised a few places in Harlem. The agent on the phone was suspicious. Do you know the neighborhood? Have you ever been to Harlem? My husband refused to look at the gem I had discovered. Harlem is a slum. You want to move to a crime-ridden era? It's a neighborhood in transition, nowhere near as bad as you think, I pleaded. Ivan grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and had witnessed the 67 riots. He had seen his parents' house lose value. He had experienced white people's fear and their ultimate flight. There's nothing going on in Harlem. We'll be away from all the action. I bet you can't even get a baguette or a decent bottle of wine in Harlem, he complained. He was right, but I begged, pleaded, threatened, and finally got him to come up to Harlem. As soon as we left the subway station, he was pleasantly surprised by the white boulevards, the architectural gems, and the friendliness of the people. Just as I had expected, he fell in love with the apartment too. When we moved in February of 99, good things started to happen right away. Bringing down the garbage for the first time, I met our super. Hi, I'm Angela. They call me the clean Nazi. I really appreciate how you separate your garbage. You do a great job tying up your recyclable newspapers and cardboard boxes, she said. After my initial shock of witnessing a black woman calling herself a Nazi, I answered, Hi, my name is Anna. Thanks for the compliment. I'm from Germany. Recycling is a religion in my homeland. You might go to jail if you don't separate your brown from your green and white glass. My kind of country. Welcome to Harlem. How do you like it so far? While I stuffed my laundry into the dryer, we talked. Angela, who was from Trinidad, didn't mind white people moving to her Harlem. We have too many people with poor breeding the way it is now. Our conversation turned personal. We found out we were the same age. I hope you don't mind me asking, but are you menopausal, she said. I stopped menstruating a year ago. A drag, isn't it? I wake up at 4 every morning and can't go back to sleep. Do you take hormones? No, I believe in really good quality dark chocolate. You're my kind of woman. On my next trip down to the basement, I bought her some of the Novesia Goldnuss Chocolate for my mother's care package. That looks different, she said as she ripped the package open. She put the first piece in her mouth and closed her eyes in blissful surrender. I have never had sex with a woman, but Angela looked positively orgasmic. I felt like a voyeur watching the chocolate and hazelnut dance around in her mouth. Finally, she opened her eyes. Good Lord, this is divine. I throw my Hershey's away for this. What makes us so good? The right kind of fat. Nothing but cocoa butter. No fillers and additives, I said. Angela licked her lips. How can I make it up to you? No need, I said. I just wanted to give you something to take the edge off those menopausal mood swings. Then I threw the bright yellow IKEA bag with my freshly laundered clothes over my shoulders and made my way up the stairs. Wait a minute, she stopped me. Do you have any plans for Saturday night? No, not really. Want to come to my birthday party? We'll have a male stripper to entertain a crowd of menopausal women. Of course I wanted to go. Harlem amazed me in many ways. Downtown, I had become invisible to men. No one stared at me, flirted with me, or complimented me any longer. The store clerks called me ma'am. In an entire year, the only man to hit on me was a smelly homeless guy who sat across from me in a subway. You are some fine babe, he said. Thank you, I replied. I appreciate that. Stepping outside in Harlem, I could always count on male attention of the hello, gorgeous, God bless you, sister variety. Some man broke out in song at the sight of me in unshapely sweatpants, my hair unwashed and untamed. Once waiting for the bus, a black BMW stopped in front of me. The driver, a black man in his 20s, decked out in hip-hop attire, rolled down the tinted window and said with tremendous urgency in his voice, I have to get to know you. Don't waste your time with a woman old enough to be your mother. Wait a minute, you are married? Very much so. Happily married? I'd say so. Listen, he doesn't have to know. Not everything was that rosy in Harlem. Couples aired their relationship drama under my window at 4 a.m. Drivers parked their cars, opened the windows, turned the music all the way up, and forced everyone to listen to Mary J. Blige. There were plenty of examples of bad parenting, mothers who cursed at their two-year-olds and fed them Pepsi and potato chips. The cheerful children's birthday parties in the park started with hundreds of balloons and large tables loaded with fried chicken, potato salad, and all kinds of delicacies, then continued half the night. The deafening rap music made me feel as if the loudspeakers were in my bedroom. Ignoring the rules, people barbecued, stank up the entire block, and left enormous heaps of garbage. High school students murdered the daffodils in the park. On my way to the subway, I passed a mural. Owning a condo on 116th Street doesn't make you a Harlemite. It told me I wasn't welcomed by everyone. I enjoyed practicing my high school French with my Senegalese neighbors. I took pleasure in the soothing views of the steep and rocky slopes of St. Nicholas Park, the early morning sparrow concerts, and the children on the swings shrieking with delight. At night, I looked up at City College's Shepherd Hall in all its illuminated splendor. I walked on St. Nicholas Terrace, startled by the magnificent view of Harlem and the Bronx skyline. I passed by the YMCA where Langston Hughes had stayed for $7 a week when he first came to New York. The Harlem pace was slow and gentle, like a European city's. One day, marching at frantic Manhattan speed, an older gentleman scolded me, "Don't rush, young lady, it's not allowed up here." At City College, the security guard was kind enough to let me in without an ID. The Great Hall was an awe-inspiring cathedral-like space. It must have been at least 4 stories high. I looked up at the splendid stained glass window, and not watching my way, I bumped into a professor. "Marvelous, isn't it?" he said. "Just imagine Mark Twain and Albert Einstein lecturing here." Maybe I could be a college student again and return to that time of promise and hope in indefinite future possibilities. I looked up to the mural showing wisdom looking down on Alma Mater and the graduate. In that moment, when I contemplated my life's journey, Miss Jackson whispered in my ear, "Ain't nobody holding you back but yourself." I fell in love with the charming desk. Made in Indonesia, it had an exotic aura and seemed perfect for a travel writer or well-traveled writer. Graham Greene, Bruce Chapman, Rudyard Kipling would have loved it. I really couldn't afford it, but treated myself to it anyway. Once I had my own desk, my love for writing returned. 8 years after moving uptown, I still delight in Harlem. Uplifting gospel music spills out of the churches on Sunday. Old people at the bus stop tell me about Harlem in its heyday, the Mother's Day celebrations, First Communion processions, fabulous dances and musical performances. A retired gentleman at the Showman's Lounge, in business since 1942, invites us to his sister's house for Thanksgiving. I often treat myself to lunch at the United House of Prayer for All People. Their cornbread and meatloaf is almost as good as Miss Jackson's. On my way over, the plaque at the Lionel Hampton houses reminds me of how much the people here love and admire their artists. God gave me the talent, Gladys gave me the inspiration. I am amazed by the countless hair salons. Many stay open 7 days a week until late at night. Veronica's Beautyrama is my favorite. She has won the KISS 98.7 Choice Award for Best Beauty Shop, made first place at Hair Battle Royale, the Ladies Avant-Garde Hair Competition, and many other hair shows. In the store windows, her plaques sit next to photographs of her prize-winning coifs. They show women with green, fire engine red, and blue hair, hair with rhinestones and glitter, hair sculpted into elaborate creations that remind me of peacocks and Mardi Gras revelers. Getting my bangs cut for $3 as opposed to $15 on the Upper West Side. I study Veronica, all dressed up in purple with purple hair and false purple eyelashes, as she performs her magic on her illustrious customers. I'm amused by the signs posted throughout the store. If you can't grow it, Veronica will sew it. In this salon, we provide many services. Recess time for your kids is not one of them. Let God take care of it. Miss Jackson would have loved it. Smiling now from heaven, she gives me the thumbs up. The Lord has turned your setbacks into comebacks. Bless your little heart, child. The end.
Thank you all for coming. Do please take just a moment to fill out those survey forms. You can just leave them where they are. We'll come collect them. And then please join us outside for reception. Thank you, writers and publishers and editors.